Tactopia. Tactopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, AM Hub, Index Award, Electronics of Tomorrow, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tactopia. I den her udgave af Tactopia, der kommer du til at møde en mand, som har gjort noget, de færreste af os nogensinde har prøvet. Han har nemlig boet 2 år og 2 timer i et fuldstændig lukket biologisk miljø, en såkaldt biosfære. Mark Nelson, han var en af de 8 personer, der fra 1991 til 1993 var lukket inde i biosfære 2. Der var sådan et slags drivhus, som stod i Arizona, hvor der både var en regnskov og koralrev og landbrug og alt muligt andet. En slags miniudgave af jorden, hvor de her 8 mennesker, de så boede i 2 år og 2 timer. Dengang i 90'erne, der blev det tænkt lidt som en miniudgave af jorden, der skulle flyttes til Mars, så man kunne bo deroppe og dyrke landbrug og i det hele taget eksistere under meget ekstreme vilkår. Men i virkeligheden så var biosfære 2 en masse andre ting, fordi det netop var en biosfære 2, nemlig den anden udgave af biosfære 1, der jo er jorden, vores planet. Så det handler om, hvordan vi mennesker kan bo i overensstemmelse med de vilkår, der nu engang er her på planeten, uden at ødelægge den. Mark Nelson, han var altså med. Han var en af de folk, der var med til at bygge biosfære 2, og han boede der i over 2 år. Han er økolog, og han har skrevet flere bøger. Og så optrådte han på Respond Festivalen hos Ingeniørforeningen IDA i foråret. Her 30 år efter, der bearbejder han stadig erfaringerne og minderne fra biosfære 2, og det er det, vi skal snakke med ham om i dag.
What was? Well, it still is. Biosphere 2, the structure still exists. Anyway, Biosphere 2 was a little over a hectare in ground area with ceilings as high as 25 meters because we anticipated, we planned for a 100-year experiment. And it was basically an experiment in what we like to call, and colleagues in the field, biospherics. How do biospheres operate? Which, of course, you know, we are intensively studying, as well as we are changing how Biosphere 1 operates the Earth. But the idea of Biosphere 2 was we need laboratories on a biospheric scale to investigate fundamental processes of ecosystems, of different biomes, and, you know, quite crucially, how to integrate properly humans, agriculture, technology with that world in a less harmful way.
So could you describe it? I mean, you were sort of starting on describing it. You had a coral reef, you have a rainforest.
Right. Let's get back to the facts and figures.
How did you actually manage to have all these things within a facility like this?
Yeah, so and you're quite right. I should give a little bit more of the physical background or the layout. There was a wilderness wing, and that was a series of interconnected biomes from rainforest, tropical savanna, a thorn scrub, which was like an ecotone between the savanna and the fog desert, a desert that's adapted to high humidity. Those were the terrestrial biomes, and there were 2 aquatic and marine ones. One of them was modeled on an estuary in the Florida Everglades, so it included everything from freshwater marsh to slightly salty, to heavily salty, like where red mangroves are. And then a mini ocean, which included, it's actually the world's largest man-made coral reef system inside, with about 4 dozen types of coral reefs. That was the wilderness wing. And air and water was shared with the rest of the facility and the other part, so biomes. Maybe I should quickly say biomes we kind of know instinctively. A rainforest is a type of biome, a coral reef is a type of marine biome, desert, etc. But in the modern world, you know, humans, our presence is great enough that ecologists are now recognizing there are 2 anthropogenic man-made biomes. One of them is our food production, that's, you know, animal production, pasture, rangeland and agriculture, farms, and the city. So we had those two anthropogenic biomes in Biosphere 2. Even though there were only eight of us, we considered that a micro city. And our agricultural system, you know, which covered about 1/5 of a hectare, you know, was designed to produce all of the food, and we designed everything in Biosphere 2 to be recycling. So we had water systems that could be completely regenerated. We regenerated our air. We produced very clean food, and all the nutrients got returned to soils.
But did you have livestock as well?
We had domestic animals. We had, kind of a mini farm. Old MacDonald had a farm. We had chickens, we had African pygmy goats, and we had a dwarf kind of pig. So we could get meat in very limited amounts. We could get eggs, milk, and milk. And in the wilderness areas, you know, all of our ecologists were trying to, you know, build sophisticated food chains. But obviously we couldn't have tigers and elephants, you know, I mean, the landmass. But we did support, and they reproduced during the time. We had these little galagos, African prosimian, kind of in the monkey family, that actually traversed all of the wilderness biomes. And they were kind of our, well, we also made pets in a way of our domestic animals. But they were a great source of entertainment.
And what about the coral reef? Does it function without animals, without fish, or
No. We had the coral reef, you know, was stocked with shrimp and fish. We actually, in the both the Everglades system and the coral reef, we actually brought back samples, you know, of water from those systems and rocks from those systems that contained it. You know, contain quite a biodiversity of animals. So yeah, we had limited populations of coral fish. And we, you know, but Biosphere 2 is really an engineering challenge, because if you make a man-made structure and there was about 200,000 cubic meters of atmosphere in Biosphere 2, you know, very tiny, but we had high ceilings because atmospheric dynamics was one of the many challenges that we faced in making a successful biospheric laboratory. We made a complete inventory before closure, and roughly we had 3,800 species of fungi, plants, and animals. And for microbial diversity, in each of the biomes, we had several different sections. For example, in the rainforest, we had an attempt at a cloud forest, you know, with misters producing the fog. We had a lowland rainforest. We had a waterfall and pool, and then a meandering stream. So we had a that kind of riverine ecology. And because we're in southern Arizona, where daylight is extremely intense, we had a ginger belt around the perimeter of the rainforest to protect the interior rainforest from harsh sunlight. And we had a bamboo belt between the rainforest and the ocean to prevent salt aerosols from impacting the rainforest. So each one of our biomes had different zones, even though they were so small to begin with.
And you spent 2 years and 2 hours in there together with 700 other people in 1991 to 1993. How was that?
Awesome. It was so awesome that I'm continuing to digest the experience. You know, it had its moments of delight, which I think far outweighed the difficult parts. And certainly, we knew it would be difficult to be cut off materially, physically isolated with only seven other human beings. And indeed, that did prove to be a problem. But the experience overall was magnificent. I mean, it was really a voyage of exploration. You know, we often joked to ourselves that we had entered a time machine, because any man-made ecosystem like that, and maybe, by the way, in our definition, we should say, to make it clear, that our aim was to be as materially airtight and watertight as possible. And the engineering was so superb that we arrived at less than 1% per month air exchange with the outside. So that also changes your thinking. So when we talk about a biosphere, just like the Earth is virtually closed to material exchange, but informationally we wanted it to be open. Of course, we had mission control and consulting scientists and engineers on the outside. The data would flow, you know, in and out, and also energetically open. So Biosphere 2 is basically sunlight powered for the plants. We had a energy system on the outside that supplied the electricity and also the heated and cooled water to try to maintain internal temperatures, because with that range of biomes, you know, our tolerance for high temperatures and low temperatures varied. We could let the desert become much hotter and much colder in the winter than the rainforest, for example.
What kind of effect did it have on you as a human being living so closely related to the biosphere, to the biomes?
Well, I think that, you know, personally was the most astonishing and the most really kind of life-changing, frankly. And the reason that I even became a trainee and a candidate to be enclosed inside, and we came up with the word biospherian for a crew member inside Biosphere 1, is I had 24 hours in a small test module that we had built. First off, to, you know, perfect some of the engineering, how to make closure, how to make it so airtight. And then we ran a number of biological experiments. We had plants from all of the biomes in there, even a little mini farm and a little apartment with a fold-out bed. It was pretty compact. It was pretty much the size of a living room, 6 meters on a side and 6 meters high. But when I spent 24 hours in there, that feeling of visceral bodily connection with that living world was incredible. And of course, in a system that small, that appreciation, it's like, you know, and I'd worked in ecology for 20 years before Biosphere 2, but suddenly, you know, the understanding of our metabolic connection, my metabolic connection with that living world went from just my brain to, it seemed like, every cell in my organism, and a wonderful feeling. And so by living in Biosphere 2 only deepened that, because we had roles to carry out. First one, keep all the machinery going and all of the equipment replacing Earth functions, grow your food, and research and study, and, you know, so we kind of felt like we were the first inhabitants, we were the first tribe of humans figuring out a biospheric culture as our very young biosphere was growing up. So it was intensely pleasurable, and it's really left me with the feeling that part of the malaise that modern people have is that, you know, for the first time in human history in the last 300 years, so many people are cut off from nature. They have a nature deficit, and they also have kind of the fantasy, like the environment and the biosphere is something outside of themselves. That's wrong, and it's also really unfulfilling to have that separation, that illusion of separation.
So you experienced sort of a connectedness, could you call it that, with nature while you were being there, because you were sharing the same oxygen and the same nutrition that you could have, which wasn't very much, as I understand it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the surprises. But, you know, as soon as I stepped into the test module, you know, within minutes, I became acutely aware that these green plants, you know, we used to say the same thing in Biosphere 2, these green plants are our third lung. They're producing the oxygen that we need and the food and, you know, helping keep the atmospheric dynamics healthy. And we're breathing out CO2 that, you know, that's fueling their growth. You know, so that's what I mean. It doesn't matter that right now this interview is now in an industrial setting. That metabolic connection that we have with our global biosphere is equally true. It's just harder to grasp it.
So looking back now, 30 years later, what can we learn from Biosphere 2 in the 21st century?
Well, you know, I just wrote a book because I've been mulling over, you know, how revolutionary and radical Biosphere 2 was. And I think the lessons that we learned in Biosphere 2, which one impelled us to make this experiment and to jump into the unknown, you know, there was no assurance we would last inside Biosphere 2 more than a few minutes or hours. You know, it was actually somewhat surprising that with some injection of oxygen, we made it for 2 years. But the relevance of Biosphere 2 is ever the greater. I think if we built Biosphere 2 now, you know, we could expend less, you know, less energy explaining it to people that we're making an experiment in, you know, we're making a test bed in figuring out how we can live sustainably, non-harmfully, and in fact regenerate the natural world that we're living with.
As I remember it, back in the 90s, it was described as an experiment on how you would live on Mars.
The tricky thing about, you know, Biosphere 2 and going through the medium of media, as it were, is that it was a complex project with a number of objectives. And certainly I don't mean to downplay that, because I still go to space conferences and I'm really interested in the development of space life support systems and how I think it's part of the human destiny that we will take Earth life with us, because we have to. We will make biospheres eventually in our solar system, and then, you know, the universe beckons, our galaxy beckons. But that's a long-term thing, and I think a lot of the people in NASA and ESA and the Japanese and Chinese space programs at first didn't really understand Biosphere 2, but then they kind of got it that, you know, just like you could live for a time with hydroponic potatoes and lettuce and wheat and tomatoes and whatever you want in a very simple system, and that's what we're going to start with when we put them on space stations and on the surface of Moon or Mars. But eventually, for just psychological health, humans need to be in a biosphere. And that's going to, you know, there's a million steps that we have to succeed with before we do that. And of course, the crucial one is we're going to have to make the structure out of in situ, you know, space materials, you know, surface of Moon or Mars. But these are technological, these are eminently achievable technologically. The time frame of that, who knows? If that's kind of a political will. But on the space front, what impelled us about the project was that there's kind of the realm of astronautics, the rocketry, you know, the machinery to get us into space and to do exploration is miles and was miles ahead of the life support capabilities when we started thinking about the project and launched it in 1984. You know, and we wanted to show that we need many of these systems because no one really knows how to make a biosphere. And I think an important lesson is that, which we were not surprised, that there were, you know, fundamental errors perhaps that we made and miscalculations inherently because we were jumping into such a field of unknowns. But before we're ever going to make one of these systems in space, we need to have them on ground on Earth and learn more about how biospheres operate. So there was a space objective. Then, but I think the other overriding one was, as I was mentioning, comparative biospherics. And so we named Biosphere 2, you know, 2 for a number of reasons, one of which, you know, was to invite the question, where is Biosphere 1? And of course, the answer is no, it wasn't another project we did in Nevada or whatever. Biosphere 1 is the only biosphere we know, and it's the reason that, you know, we humans are alive now, that it's been changing the face of the Earth for 4 billion years. And then because Biosphere 2 sort of tapped this global nerve, we really thought that Biosphere 2 in southern Arizona was going to be a quiet, you know, R&D project. And eventually, because it was privately financed, we'd make the money back by selling it to Tokyo or Paris or London or Copenhagen, maybe. But the thing is that Biosphere 2, you know, we like to make beautiful projects. So the architects, you know, paid homage to world architecture, and it's a stunning, stunning building. It attracted the world attention. So suddenly we realized we're also in the field of biospheric education. And Biosphere 2 went out to uncountable, you know, I'm told that close to 1 billion people watched our re-entry, as we called it, our exit from Biosphere 2 after the 2 years and before a second team went in. So we reached an incredible world audience with a very optimistic picture that, you know, the premise of the experiment was that there will be difficulties and there'll be unknowns, but we can figure out, and this really speaks to an engineering audience, because the engineers had to make a technosphere, the world of technology inside Biosphere 2 had one overriding objective: support life and not poison it.
So what kind of challenges did the engineers have?
Well, of course, the engineers, you know, first off, we had to find engineers that were really willing to go out into the new. Nobody had ever sealed a system that tightly. And then when we began detailed work on designing the biomes, we had this really interesting situation that the engineers had to learn the language of ecology, and the ecologists, you know, and we had a wonderful team of ecologists on each of the biomes, they had to learn enough engineering language that they could communicate what they needed the engineers to do. And at first it was, you know, I kind of joked that they couldn't even insult each other because they were basically talking two different languages. And the engineers almost rebelled twice. First is when they looked at the complex and beautiful architecture, they said, oh my God, you know, this can make sealing this system, you know, extremely difficult. Why don't you just do a big rectangle, big box store? And we were like, you know, we've got the gumption, the audacity to even think about making the first, you know, human design biosphere. It's going to be beautiful. And I think about, you know, the consequences of that. But the other, you know, if my 2 years had been inside a box, it would have been quite a different experience than living with magnificent architecture. And because we touched the nerve, we were able to put out a model for people to think about what a biosphere is and to see 8 people living inside. And at the time, in the early 90s, when we were doing the project, people, even the word biosphere was unknown to people. We had to spell that. But the other place where the engineers were outside their comfort zone is when they realized that all of the great and innovative technology that they had to design, for example, how do you make a wave in the ocean without destroying a lot of marine life, you know, going through pumps to produce the waves. Well, they came up with a vacuum system. So our old man in the sea, because that's kind of what it sounded like, or maybe a whale sounding, would suck up 10,000 gallons of water, 40,000 liters, about every minute or so, and then gently release it to produce the waves and the water circulation that coral reefs need to be healthy. But when the engineers realized that all of the innovative engineering wasn't going to ensure that Biosphere 2 is healthy, that was going to depend on the plants and the animals and the fungi and the untold microbes and all of our different soils and aquatic bodies, that's kind of against the engineering ethos. And I have to say, I fell in love with engineers because, a really great engineer, you know, wants to ensure that, you know, what he designs is going to preserve human life and not malfunction. Bridges are going to stay up. Buildings are not going to blow over in the wind. And I think during that process, as the ecologists understood the context of every engineering decision, and it was like a spaceship in a way. If you there are many consequences when you actually materially seal something. So it's like, you know, space engineers, before any bit of material or equipment goes into a spaceship or a space station, they're madly looking at what are the outgassing, you know, what are the waste products of these systems, and what trace gases and impact on water systems they will have. Well, we had that, you know, to the nth degree. So the engineering had to be very innovative. It had to serve life, and it had to use materials and equipment that could be integrated and the byproducts incorporated by the living systems inside. But when the engineers finally got that, they were like ecstatic. And I was thinking, my God, why don't we do this on the outside? Engineers kind of design the world that we're living in, the technosphere anyway. And why don't we give them real ecological tools so that they know the context? And I think that's, again, you know, growing up in the Anthropocene, I can see that right on the horizon. That's where we're going. We're not going to abandon technology, but we're going to, you know, really fine-tune it and understand the ecological context of it. The solution to pollution is not dilution. The solution to pollution is avoiding polluting technologies and inventing ways for life to be able to integrate any byproduct of technology.
Which actually brings me to another term that you mentioned the other day, the Anthropocene, because right. You also talk about how you can actually, when you created this coral reef, artificial coral reef inside, you also took tests from it and brought it to the outside, so you can actually save the coral reef in the biosphere one, or how does it work?
No, but there are many things that we did in biosphere two that informed opinion was you can't do it. So you can't really take an Everglades ecosystem in Florida and take it to Arizona with, you know, up at 1,000 meter kilometer of altitude, different seasons, different day lengths, same with the coral reef. So we're making a coral reef system, you know, in way, way far from the tropics. So I think we really don't even know how adaptable systems are. And I don't mean to say that the world isn't fragile and we can run roughshod over it, but I'm glad you brought up the Anthropocene, because, you know, from the standpoint of kind of a longer perspective, you know, humans have always been changing the environment, but the Industrial Revolution and our increasing numbers have meant that the impact of humans on the planet is sort of on the level of a geologic force. But I think that, and it's kind of obvious, that we're in baby steps, the first chapter of the Anthropocene. And yeah, we had no idea when people invented the internal combustion engine and started using fossil fuels what the impacts would be. But we're beginning to get through more sophisticated engineering and science and understanding that we're living in a closed world and that we need to factor in and basically re-engineer our technosphere as if we were in a tightly sealed and recirculating system, which we are. Just biosphere two, why it was a time machine, was that when you make a small world and pack it with life, literally things speed up. So the carbon, for example, a carbon dioxide molecule in Earth's atmosphere stays there on average 3 years. That's the residence time. In biosphere two, it was between 2 and 4 days. So every year that we're in there, we were having, you know, between 90 and 180 cycles of that CO2. And then there was the other fun factor, is that we weren't the greatest of farmers. We got a lot better during the 2 years because hunger is a great motivator. So we were following the calorie-restricted, nutrient-dense diet that our resident doctor, Roy Walford from UCLA, had, you know, been studying in lab rats, and it produces really great health improvements, drops cholesterol, strengthens the immune system. So our other joke was we might spend 2 years in biosphere two, but metabolically, health-wise, you know, we were becoming younger and healthier. So there were all of these really interesting changes of cycles that were going on.
But did you actually become younger and healthier metabolic-wise when you entered the outside? Did you feel better?
We did, actually, and it probably, and also we were growing everything beyond organically. So we produce, we're shooting for 100% food production. We achieved about 85%, but then we made system improvements and better crop selection. So the second crew that was in there for about 6.5 months achieved 100%. Yeah, so we are eating amazingly healthy, fresh food. Our cholesterol dropped to levels, you know, that we hadn't been since we were children. And the human organism actually gets much better under that regime. So we're undernourished, but not malnourished. Mm. Yeah. And it's kind of psychologically a little difficult for, you know, what were we, 5 Americans and 3 Europeans? Suddenly there was no way to cheat, go to a convenience store, go out and have a fast food meal. So our bodies actually became more adept at extracting all the nutrients from the food that we were bringing in. 5 of us went in a metabolic chamber right after we came out, where they could further study, you know, our metabolism. And for Roy Walford, he was in seventh heaven because his people he'd helped get PhDs in the field were just starting controlled experiments with primates. Suddenly he had seven human beings, or 8 human beings rather, and we documented every bit of food that we brought in, you know, so he had great data on these health improvements.
The term biosphere, you mentioned in your talk the other day, a Russian thinker, Vernadsky.
Yeah, I mean, you know, great inspiration for all of our work in ecotechnics was that we discovered someone who's absolutely like, he's like Darwin, you know, for Russians, is Vladimir Vernadsky, who I guess starting in the 1910s, 20s, he taught at the Sorbonne, returned to then the Soviet Union. And he was he started out as a geochemist. And he actually is also considered the father of biogeochemistry, because he began to discover how much of what had previously been considered to be geologic deposits was actually the result of life. And that kind of informed the vision that he had. I think, you know, Vernadsky has given us basically the modern understanding of the biosphere. And I contrast it with when I went through, you know, university and got educated in the 50s and 60s. You know, the dominant thinking was that both humans and life were kind of, we're lucky passengers. Isn't it really nice that we're in a perfect world that is so life supporting? Now, Vernadsky kind of turned that on its head, that the biosphere over close to 4 billion years has actually shaped the Earth. You know, it was life forms that changed the early atmosphere to one rich in oxygen. So very, very profound. And also from that Vernadsky school, you know, they introduced, and we adopted because it made so much sense, that, you know, there's the biosphere and there's the technosphere. And in our modern world, you know, because our technosphere was not really designed and engineered to live in a biosphere, there's a great deal. I think one of the early environmental works of the 60s was Barry Commoner, Making Peace with the Planet, and he was kind of like on that. The technology, in a way, is waging war against the biosphere, and God forbid that, you know, technology wins, because the biosphere is the fundamentals of our life support. So anyway, the Vernadsky tradition, you know, is extremely inspirational to us. And curiously, the leaders in our field of bioregenerative life support, closed ecological systems, were groups in Moscow and in Siberia at several of their institutes. And, you know, when we came to tell them about our thoughts about Biosphere 2, they were ecstatic. It's like, you know, you're going to bring this field to a kind of Vernadskyan biospheric level. So we got tremendous assistance from these people. Now, Vernadsky also could see, and he died in 1945, that the magnitude of the technosphere, I mean, I think in his quaint language, he said, technology and mankind, we're a geologic force on planet Earth. So he envisioned that the next step, in a way, or a next step in human evolution, was the noosphere, a sphere of intelligence where we regulate ourselves. We can't manage the biosphere. It's way bigger than, it's total hubris and fantasy, the people who think that we can manage this planet. But we need to manage intelligently our actions and the consequences of our action. So that idea of the noosphere, you know, is it an interesting way. I think the Anthropocene is pointing to the same reality, that if humans are that large a vector on the planet and the main disturbing, you know, influence, or at least one of the major ones, then we have to be intelligent and figure out how to make that work. So that ties back to that original insight that, you know, the Institute of Ecotechnics, we began working in 1969 in New Mexico. But, you know, that idea that we would work on projects and try to get a healthier balance of eco and techno, you know, runs through the work I've been doing now for five decades, amazingly.
So that would also be your message to the humans of the 21st century, this balance and how to manage the noosphere?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the noosphere is an optimistic concept. I mean, I'm waiting for an outbreak of intelligence on a global scale, and I think we're starting to see that. You know, as I say, you know, biosphere, sustainability, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, these are words that were obscure, hidden away in some academic closet 30 years ago. And now, you know, anyone who's paying attention can see that we're approaching really serious, you know, critical times where we've got to change the way we live. Business as usual, the technosphere as usual, is a disaster for the planet. And it's a disaster for human well-being and health. So I think that this is the other thing. I don't think, you know, environmentalists, and I don't like the word environment because it makes it sound like it's outside of it. It's really, you know, it will be so satisfying for humans to regain that instinctive connection with nature that I think, you know, dominated human history when we were closer to, when most of us were growing our own food and building our own houses and living close to nature. That's going to be a very liberating realization. Of course, you know, what I struggle with, and, you know, many other people, is how do you wake people up to that reality? That is the reality. This feeling that nature is somehow outside of us is a fantasy. It's literally an illusion.
But then again, most of the people on the planet these days live in big cities, and more people will live in big cities in the future.
Right.
So how do you actually reconnect and regain this balance with nature?
Well, you know, I'm all for win-win, you know, solutions, because I think, you know, making our world, you know, a better place to live and protecting, you know, the diversity and the biomes of the planet is critical to us living a healthy human life. Yeah, let's green cities then. I mean, I grew up in New York. I grew up in Queens. A lot of beautiful parks. I can't imagine Central Park, Manhattan without Central Park. You know, and we have, E.O. Wilson, you know, termed the word biophilia. I think deeply, you know, wired in all of us is that we want to be connected. You know, that's very meaningful. I mean, we chose that word biosphere, and rather than econaut or bionaut, you know, with the idea that eventually people will say, if I'm living in biosphere one, what does that make me? And how should I act? How should that inform, you know, my conduct? But I think that, you know, I think just like we had to learn how to operate biosphere two, and famously Bucky Fuller said, you know, it may be spaceship Earth, but there's no operating manual that came with it. We're going to need to figure out the operating manual. So I kind of think, you know, learning to be a biospherian and embracing that role, and it doesn't matter, you know, I don't care if you're in a city and you're working in front of a computer. You know, the reality is that you are metabolically and probably spiritually a child and connected to the biosphere. You know, so, and I think that's, you look at a lot of the cultures of our planet, and a lot of their really healthy side is celebrating, you know, regarding the earth and every piece of it as sacred, and the connection we have. Hunting cultures that pay homage to the spirit of the animal before they go out and hunt. You know, there's a reference, I think, that we need. We need to fall in love with the biosphere. Then we'll fight to save it.
Du hørte økologen Mark Nelson, der oprindeligt deltog i Biosfære 2-eksperimentet i USA tilbage i 90'erne. Jeg linker til ham og til hans bøger fra tektopia.dk. Du kan som altid skrive til mig på henrik@tektopia.dk, og du kan deltage i diskussionen i vores Facebook-gruppe Tektopia Backstage. Du kan følge podcasten på Twitter på @tektopia.dk, og så er du rigtig, rigtig velkommen til at abonnere og anmelde Tektopia på den podcast-service, du nu engang bruger. Og netop det der med at abonnere på podcasten og anmelde den, det er faktisk vigtigt for, at vi kan komme ud til flere brugere, så det håber jeg, at du virkelig vil gøre. Og så vil jeg bare sige på genhør i næste uge, og lev nu ordentligt her i den her biosfære 1, som vi har her på jorden. Det er faktisk den eneste, vi har, så vi skal passe godt på den og leve i overensstemmelse med de vilkår, der nu engang er for planter og dyr og mennesker, ligesom Mark Nelson han fortalte os.
Tektopia. Tektopia. Tektopia.
Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, AM Hub, Index Award, Electronics of Tomorrow, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia.
Tektopia.